Hey there, Dr. Alan Christensen here. Today we're mapping metabolism on the 15-minute matrix.
Welcome to the 15-minute matrix. I'm Andrea Nakayama, functional medicine nutritionist and your host. This is the podcast that brings you bite-sized insights and lessons on how to use the most important tool in functional medicine and functional nutrition. Today on the 15-Minute Matrix, I'll be talking with my good friend, Dr. Alan Christensen. Dr. C is a New York Times best-selling author and a Phoenix, Arizona-based naturopathic medical doctor who specializes in natural endocrinology with a focus on thyroid disorders. He is the author of The Adrenal Reset Diet, The Complete Idiot's Guide to Thyroid Disease, and Healing Hashimoto's, A Savvy Patient's Guide, as well as his newest book, The Metabolism Reset Diet. Dr. Christensen is the founding president and is currently the acting president of the Endocrine Association of Naturopathic Physicians. But most importantly, Dr. C has more than 80,000 patient care visits under his belt and has seen firsthand the power of diet and how it can affect the hormones. So let's get started talking about metabolism. Dr. C, welcome to the 15-Minute Matrix.
Hey, thanks for having me.
I am so excited to talk about metabolism with you today. It's a term that I think is thrown around a lot without a lot of understanding of what it is or what's happening in the body. And I know practitioners do know what metabolism is, but how do you define it?
You know, it's really just how your body forms energy. And when it works well, you don't store a lot of extra energy in the form of toxic, harmful fat, and you keep your energy level steady, even if you haven't eaten for a little bit.
When we're thinking about the central part of the functional nutrition matrix, the part that I like to call the soup of the matrix, are there particular organs that you associate with either good or quote unquote bad metabolism?
Well, they're all involved, but one that's super important that's often not thought of is the liver. You know, it plays a big role in storing any fuel that you're not using in the moment and then getting it out to keep meeting the body's needs.
And how is it impacted by, say, the environmental inputs or any particular antecedents or triggers that a patient might be experiencing?
That's a big factor. There's so many things we're exposed to in the environment, and the liver is pretty much where we interact with the environment. We've talked about the intestinal tract, and it's certainly relevant, but the intestinal tract is still outside the body until you absorb things. And once you do, the liver is pretty much the port of entry for whatever is coming into the system. So food, any bacteria we're exposed to from the diet, intentionally or unintentionally, and then, of course, the environmental waste that can come into us all are interfacing with the liver directly.
When you're working with your patient population in the clinic, Dr. C, are there people who have particular issues with metabolism? Have you been able to see sort of like classifications of histories or triggers in particular?
The ones I was mentioning as far as just struggles getting energy and weight right seem to apply to the vast majority of people. And certainly things can be triggers that give rise to that. Changes in thyroid function, in adrenal health, moving through perimenopause, menopause, or andropause for guys. These can all be precipitators, but it's pretty common stuff.
And when you say in your new book, which I'm excited to share with everybody in the show notes, heal your liver and the liver holds the key, how do we go about doing that with clients and patients to support their metabolic function?
A lot of approaches have thought about adding in certain foods or herbs that are useful for the liver, and those can have some benefit. Others have thought about fasting or food restriction with the idea of pulling waste out of stores. And I use some of both of those strategies, but the trick is to have a low enough intake of foods that become fuel, you know, mostly fats and carbs, but then still providing enough nourishment for the liver to work well. The paradox about the body detoxing is that it won't happen if there's a huge amount of energy coming in, or even a break-even amount of energy coming in. But when it does happen, your liver's got to work harder than normal. So the trick is to feed the liver through that process.
Is there a key then to what you've seen on the plate or particular foods or lifestyle habits that support the liver functioning in that balanced state that support metabolism?
Generally, maintaining a good healthy metabolism is a little more straightforward. High amounts of a diverse category of fibers from a lot of different categories of plant foods makes a big difference. Healthy, clean amounts of protein, good hydration, healthy movement. The trick is really how to get someone back there if they're not there already.
What do we do to get somebody back there when they're not there already? Any key tips?
Yeah, we did a clinical trial showing that a combination of low amounts of fats and carbs with pretty good amounts of protein, and then a lot of targeted food groups, things like you hear about the cruciferous vegetables, which are great. We also added in a lot of the APACA vegetables, which have some unique effects upon regulating liver function, and then also a fair amount of resistant starch, which helps a lot with forming short-chain fatty acids that aid in liver detox and blood sugar regulation.
And what's your favorite form of resistant starch that you like to bring in?
The densest common food sources of it are going to be boiled white potatoes, white beans, navy, northern, and cannellini, and then underripe bananas or plantains. And in terms of total quantities, the highest ones are going to be the underripe bananas or plantains, followed up by the boiled and then chilled white potatoes.
That's a key point there. People think they can eat their potatoes hot and mashed. And in fact, we need the chilled potatoes to get that resistant starch. How about that resistant starch? How does it go from being one starch to another?
Some foods, there's about three types of it naturally occurring, then a couple types of it that are synthesized. It's unique in that it gives us energy, but only after the bacteria have had their first pass at it. Most things, we get energy because we absorb it into our bloodstream from the large intestine. But resistant starch is assimilated in the colon after the bacteria have accessed it. So it's pretty different in that regard. And it's not requiring insulin to process or stabilize. And it yields just long periods of time with steady, even blood sugar. So it's a real powerful food category unto itself.
I'm wondering what some of the downstream effects of an imbalance or poor metabolism are. What do you see with patients who are struggling with metabolism for even further upstream liver issues, but then are they having downstream signs or symptoms related to poor metabolism other than weight gain that we might be on high alert for?
For sure. The most common thing is just erratic energy levels. They'll feel real well, perhaps after a dose of caffeine or after a meal, but it's not stable and it's not lasting. It's going to vary quite a bit throughout the day. Mm-hmm. And then the other variable we're seeing is just the total inflammatory load. I think a lot about the various triggers of inflammation, the toxicants, the chronic infections, the immune triggers like allergies. And it's tough to compare. A lot of bad things can be equally bad and just differently bad. But it seems that these adipokines, these toxic inflammatory chemicals that come out of the fat from the liver, may be among the biggest things that push our body into states of disease.
It's kind of fascinating because I think we all see those patients in our clinics that are struggling to lose weight, and it appears that they're doing everything, quote unquote, right. And so it means we have to go a bit deeper to look at where this sort of internal chemistry has gone awry.
Mm-hmm, completely.
Where do things like a past diet that is overly restrictive or kind of yo-yo dieting, people changing, or these diets that are fad diets that people take on, how does that impact our overall metabolism?
One problem is that when the liver's healthy, it's got fuel in two forms called glycogen and triglycerides. And I think about it like kindling and logs. You want logs because they burn for a long time and give a lot of gentle, steady heat, but you can't light them with a match.
Right.
So you need some kindling. A lot of restrictive diets, it's easy to make triglycerides, but it's harder to make glycogen. So a lot of people end up with so much triglycerides, so much of this log, so to speak, that they can't get it lit. They can't really burn it effectively because they're too low in glycogen.
So these restricted diets where they might be eating either too much fat, or which diets do you see kind of trigger further problems with metabolism?
The worst in this capacity are the ones that are extremely low in carbohydrate. You can make triglycerides out of carbs or fats or exogenous ketones or even alcohol, but glycogen you can only make out of carbohydrate. And when that's gone, people think about ketosis as when they're burning fat, but that's a bit of a misnomer. It's actually when you can't burn fat, then you form it into ketones. And the pitfall is the liver is the only organ that cannot burn ketones for fuel. So it ends up, if you're losing weight and you're highly ketogenic, you may have a lot of waste coming out and your liver has less fuel to really process those things.
We've become such a carb phobic society with the rise in ketogenic diets and kind of the return of the high protein, high fat situation, low carb. So many things are looking in that direction. How do you talk to a patient who comes to see you who is carb phobic?
I'll tell them about how to your liver, it's all the same. You make energy ultimately by breaking down your food into something called oxaloacetate. And carbs, fats, ketones, they're all the same at that level of oxaloacetate. And so if the amount and the capacity to burn effectively is not there, any of them can cause a buildup.
Do you find people get it and they're ready to make changes? Or is there some resistance?
You've seen these fad cycles come and go too. And
yeah.
People that we interact with now have already tried extreme low carb or tried keto. And most that do come in have been frustrated because they didn't get all the way they wanted to go, or it didn't last, or it slowed their thyroid further or something. So then they end up being receptive from just their firsthand experience.
When you're bringing in different kinds of starch and fiber, do you have favorite forms that you are thinking about in terms of like types of fiber in addition to the resistant starch?
Yeah, there's about 15 pretty active biological categories of fiber in the diet. And I just love to have a big amount of variety so you can cover the bases on that. The data keeps getting hit or miss about the effects of probiotics, but dietary prebiotics are hugely helpful for the flora and liver function. So I think about just as many food categories as possible for someone, that be that intact whole grains, legumes, and nuts, seeds, fruits, vegetables. And we always talk about the importance of variety, but sometimes I think we miss the relevance of variety of the macro category, not just like three kinds of greens, that's awesome, but also like variety of categories being a big thing.
I love how we can think about how those prebiotics are actually feeding the good bacteria. I did a great interview with Dr. Michael Ash, which those of you who are listening can go back and find. And that's looking at our pectin as a fiber type. There's cellulose. There's all different kinds. There's inulin. There's different kinds of fibers that we can be bringing in that add to that variety that we can be thinking about. What about the patient who has issues with the consumption of some of these fibers, either digestive issues or any other kind of issue that they're experiencing when they take it in? Do you customize a diet that's adding in these fibers?
For sure. And I encourage lots of types. And there are people to where they'll be symptomatic. And the paradox is that the more symptomatic they are, the more sign that it is that their bowel flora is not resilient and not robust and not reflective of a large, diverse array of types of bacteria. It's not so much that what they're doing is mistaken or harmful for them. It's more a matter of just like starting a new workout. You just got to take your time and phase things in. Ultimately, it'll end up being useful.
I love that you said that because I think oftentimes we all jump, whether we're patients or practitioners, to the treatment, so to speak, and whether that treatment is dietary or not, we jump to the optimal. And I always say we're looking at the heel, not the ideal. So even though you might want to bring something in, it might not be time yet. There might be some healing that needs to happen before we can work towards that ideal.
Yeah.
I know you're talking about protein. There's a lot of focus on high protein. Where do you fall with sort of like a optimal range in terms of activating metabolism?
So protein, a lot of different ways to think of it. One group will talk about how hard it is to be protein deficient, you know, to get a protein deficiency disease. Totally true. You're not readily going to get a deficiency of it unless you're just starving and too low on food. Other groups, we got to differentiate health span and lifespan. So some are thinking a lot about how could we change lifespan, extend human longevity past where it seems to be possible. And then we think about health span. How many years can you make it and be robust and not die early from chronic disease. There's some intriguing information about possible low protein extending lifespan. I would argue that from my eye on that research, it's pretty speculative and it's highly animal study based. And especially when we get down to metabolic rate and lifespan, rodents and people are very different. It's tough to really make strong comparisons. So there's speculative data that protein restriction may extend lifespan. But if we look at human data, there's a lot of human data about health span and about as people age, are they frail and do they break bones? Do they lose their muscle mass and therefore develop pneumonia because they've got less resistance? And there's really good data that those who are more on an optimal protein side do better on the health span. So I find that evidence more compelling. And there's intakes that are high, that are excessive, that are just not shown to be a benefit. And I wouldn't push that direction, like looking for extreme muscle mass development, for example. It takes a bit of thought to maintain a protein intake while your total food intake is lower. So it does take focusing on some foods that have more protein per calorie so you can break even and keep your liver and your muscle functioning while your body is breaking down some fat stores.
Well, this makes it very compelling for everybody to get their hands on your book. Dr. C, I'm wondering if there was any other fun fact that you learned through your research and your clinical trial that you would want practitioners to know.
We've really come to expect reversals of type 2 diabetes with the protocol. We see that really consistently. Blood lipids, especially triglycerides, changes in blood pressure, very consistent. The part that's really excited and intrigued me, and I guess I wasn't expecting as much at first, was how much chronic inflammatory symptoms can resolve from the same process. Chronic arthritis, autoimmune disease, chronic infections like Epstein-Barr, we're getting tons of feedback from people about a lot of these ongoing inflammatory conditions. And oftentimes, it doesn't require something as mysterious or complicated as you might think. It's just a matter of getting rid of some of that toxic organ fat from the liver.
So beautiful. Thank you for the work you do and stretching out into some areas that could be controversial and also shedding light on the important topic of metabolism.
My pleasure. Thank you so much.
The 15-Minute Matrix is brought to you by me, Andrea Nakayama, and the Functional Nutrition Alliance. The 15-Minute Matrix team includes my son, Gilbert Nakayama, and Carla Schaefer on sound production, Renee Hunt, Natalie Merrill, and Christine Shook. You can visit us and hear more episodes at 15minutematrix.com. And if you'd like to be notified each time there's a new podcast episode ready and waiting for you, please go to 15minutematrix.com/notify. And we'll be sure to drop into your inbox with a super short reminder that a new episode is ready for you. Plus, we'd love to hear from you. Please do email us. Let us know how you like the podcast so far and who you'd like to hear on the 15-Minute Matrix. Also, what topics you'd like to hear mapped. You can always email us at ask@15minutematrix.com.